Nightlife. Bite-sized history.
If you've ever crossed the Nullarbor by train, marvelled at Fremantle Harbour or visited West Australia's goldfields, you would have witnessed the handiwork of Sir John Forrest. After a pretty modest start to life as one of 10 kids born to servants in WA, Forrest first made his name as an intrepid explorer and surveyor before embarking on a lengthy political career. He was West Australia's first premier and oversaw a raft of industrial, social and political reforms in the late 1800s before becoming a founding father of Federation and embarking on 18 years in federal politics, which saw him narrowly miss out on becoming Prime Minister. You may also know him as the great-great-uncle of iron ore mining magnate Andrew Twiggy Forrest. Deborah Gare is the Professor of History at the University of Notre Dame in Fremantle and is here to tell you about this WA trailblazer. Deborah, good evening. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Hi, Philip. It's lovely to be with you again. How are you?
I'm well. Sir John achieved an incredible amount during his lifetime, although he had a modest start to life in Bunbury. Tell us about how it all began.
Well, as you said, he was born into a really large family. His parents were indentured servants. That was quite common in the early decades of the Swan River Colony. That was how, I guess, the economy itself was established here. And so land would be granted to usually a gentleman who would arrive with a certain amount of capital. And the government, the colony, the governor himself, would award land based on the amount that somebody would bring with them. And the governor would be looking at a migrant and saying, well, how much cash have you brought? How many servants have you brought with you? How many crops, you know, how much seed have you got? What equipment have you brought with you? Mm-hmm. And as a package, the governor would then award land to an incoming migrant. And in the case of the Forrests, they were amongst the indentured servants of Dr. John Ferguson. So they become part of the package that Ferguson convinces the governor of and says, you know, I'm a man of means. I've brought these Forrests here with me from Scotland and I deserve a certain amount of land. So they end up settling near Bunbury in Picton and that's where the Forrests themselves, you know, are established in the first instance when they arrive in Western Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And then after, I think it's about 1847, the John Forrest's parents win their freedom. They've essentially completed the terms of their contract and then they set themselves up as independent farmers not far from Bunbury there in Picton.
On what land?
Oh, it was pretty grim country in those days.
But did they get what? So they got some land, or
they would have? Yeah, they would have had a little land. They didn't have the kind. They wouldn't, I don't believe, have had the kind of access to land, the volume of land that, say, Ferguson had because he'd arrived.
But
with,
they would have been granted
this capital.
They would have been granted some, would they?
Some land, and from there they became farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding is that they also operated a mill as well.
Okay. John finishes an apprenticeship with a surveyor in Bunbury and joins the office of the Surveyor General. And it doesn't take long before he's sent on two major expeditions, one to look for traces of the missing explorer Ludwig Leichhardt, and another retracing the steps of Edward John Eyre from WA to South Australia. They're pretty significant expeditions, weren't they?
They really were. And, you know, he was still very, very young. The first expedition that he led, which was the one in which they were searching for Leichhardt, he was only 21, you know.
But he was a qualified surveyor by then, was he?
He was. He qualified at 16. So, well, he was apprenticed at 16, I should say. And that was having – now, see, he in itself – this is also really interesting. He had been sent by his parents to Hales School, to Bishop Hales School in Perth. He and his older brothers had all been educated there. And that in itself is a significant investment by the family in his – professional future, the fact that he's being educated and by such an establishment institution. And yet it still sets them apart because those who were truly wealthy and those that were truly part of the establishment then, where they could, continue to send their children back to Britain for education.
Right.
So Forrest was sent to Bishop's School, so he's one of the early colonial-born elite or the early colonial-born privileged educated young men. And then having finished school early, he was then apprenticed at 16 as a surveyor, but he had returned to Bunbury to do that. So he learned very, very quickly, not just through school, but also through his professional apprenticeship. He learned very quickly the skills with which to survive, the skills with which to interpret country and landscape, but also to navigate.
He must have been good in the bush, though, wasn't he?
Absolutely, absolutely. And if you think about the isolation in which his family would have been living as he grew up, you know, that, and it's easy to forget exactly how small the colonial society was then. You know, so when he was born, they hadn't yet started convict transportation to Western Australia. So the numbers are something like there were thousands of people, not tens of thousands of people in the colony. Mm. And the number, by the time he was born, they hadn't grown any more in actual number than the number that had arrived in that first year of settlement in 1829. It was struggling so much. So they were, you know, they were isolated. They were a big member of a very small community, but certainly they learnt highly practical skills, that's for sure.
He embarks on a third expedition in 1874 and heads right off into the centre of WA with the aim of reaching Adelaide again, but he nearly loses his life along the way. What happened?
Yeah, that's right. This is the second time that he makes it to Adelaide. This one was certainly more challenging. His previous expeditions, he travelled with about six men on each expedition and about 16 horses. And this time he knew that it would be more difficult, and he travelled with about the same volume of men but more horses. I think he had about 21 horses. By the time they got to Adelaide, there was something like six horses left that had survived that trip.
Wow.
So they were, really short supply, of short supply of water for the duration of that expedition. But equally, this was where we really see Forrest engaging in what we now think of as the frontier wars. He's crossing traditional country that had yet been charted by the British.
Mm-hmm.
And he encounters traditional Aboriginal communities and societies, and there is definitely conflict that he's part of. And the traditional story, as it was written up, 100 years ago, was that, he nearly lost his life because of incidents of violence.
So was he involved in massacres?
I don't know what happened on that trip. Others might, but we'd certainly know that there was definitely conflict, and there was definitely armed conflict as a result of his expedition across there, that's for sure.
All right, his expeditions earn him acclaim. He gets granted land, and then he marries a wealthy French-born socialite, Margaret Elvia Hammersley, in 1876. And, geez, he's advancing quickly, because 3 years after his marriage, he's appointed Surveyor General and becomes the first colonial born West Australian to be admitted to WA's Executive Council.
That's right.
By 1890, he's WA's first Premier and remains so for a decade. So he's got talents, this boy, hasn't he?
He does have talent, but he's very ambitious. He's very competent. So he's not somebody who's climbing the ladder through, social connection or something.
Or privilege.
That's right. You're absolutely right. He's powerfully competent. He's made a name for himself, as is his brother Alec Forrest, who was on some of those expeditions with him. So he's made a name for himself. We there's evidence already that he's regarded as being competent, possibly brilliant. He's delivered all of these extraordinary outcomes from these expeditions. He becomes very well connected socially through his marriage, that's for sure. And then I think that combination of both his skill and his wife's social position, he sees a rapid escalation in his professional fortunes. Yeah, definitely.
I'm speaking with Professor of History at the University of Notre Dame in Fremantle, Deborah Gare, and we're talking about the life and times of Sir John Forrest, a great West Australian, a great Australian in many ways too. He was a founding father of Federation. So he was despite WA's misgivings in general about becoming part of the Federation, he was a keen proponent of it, was he?
There's mixed stories about Forrest's engagement in the that march to the Federation, or that negotiation around federalism. Some people think he was a bit reluctantly committed to it.
Like most in WA.
like most in WA. I think he was actually, there's evidence that suggests he's probably the only reason that we did join the Federation when we did.
Mm-hmm.
He was dealing with some really complex political issues, one of which were the interests of the goldfields, which had a high population of people that had come from the eastern colonies, so therefore instinctively were open, seeking that union with the eastern colonies they'd just come from.
Mm-hmm.
So he had to be responsive to their interests. But most of his own personal political support came from the agricultural districts, and they were highly sceptical of Federation, and they were very concerned about the impact it would have on their trade, on the economy and so on. So he had to really juggle quite a number of different competing interests in the colony. And in the end, he was advocating for a decent deal for Western Australia to join. He didn't get any of the things he asked for, mm-hmm. but he was able to convince West Australians that if they didn't join now, then the deal they might be offered in the future might be much worse. And so it was through pragmatism, essentially, that he was able to convince them to join.
Mm. I see. So he becomes, he joins the federal parliament himself.
He gets
selected as an MP in the seat of Swan.
That's right.
And he's there for 18 years in federal politics.
Yeah.
He's Minister for Defence, uh-huh. Home Affairs, Treasurer. Yep. So, like, mm-hmm. I mean, these are really senior positions.
He's
Treasurer when World War I breaks out.
He is.
How does that affect his?
He's treasurer about career. Five times between 1901 and 1918. He serves in five ministries, and really that role as treasurer is probably the most important role that he takes. In those first few decades of the Federation. There's other roles. He does have an interest in defence because that was the first ministry that he had, and he brought. He brought, for instance, the Australian troops home as Australians from the war in South Africa in that role.
Mm-hmm.
But when it came to the outbreak of the First World War in 1914, his government lost a double dissolution election within weeks of the outbreak of that war. But he had a few weeks, just a few, between the commencement of the war and his party losing the election. And it was in that moment as treasurer that he was the one then that authorised the funding of the Australian Imperial Force of the AIF. So essentially he hands over the money with which we collect the AIF, which we enable the AIF. Yeah.
He wanted to become Prime Minister, didn't he?
I think so.
Why did he fail? Was it the rat Billy Hughes again, or was it?
Well, he does at one stage serve in a coalition with Billy Hughes. Mm. That certainly Hughes thwarts his intention or his ambition to become Prime Minister on at least one, probably more, occasions.
Mm-hmm.
The West Australian story, for which I've got a little sympathy for, is that because of who he was and, more importantly, where he came from, he was marginalised and managed by the powerful eastern states political elite, which is, a recurring theme in West Australian political history in the century that follows.
Yeah.
There's quite a number of decent men that didn't quite become, Prime Minister, but might have in the last 100 years. And so he's really the first of a long line of those stories. But he's always, nonetheless, I think that it's possible to overstate the degree to which he was overlooked because, nonetheless, he was in very significant ministries, for the duration of his parliamentary service in the federal parliament. There were all those stints as federal treasurer, there were all those other ministries that he had. And importantly, he becomes the first Australian nominated for a lordship. He becomes the first Australian baron.
He becomes recommended for a peerage in 1918.
Absolutely.
He's knighted, of course, in 1891. But,
yes.
But he's the first Australian to be recommended for a peerage.
That's right.
He never gets to take up his seat in the House of Lords because he dies.
That's right. So I'm never entirely certain about the paperwork that went along with his peerage. He was en route to London in 1918. He was with his wife. They were on a ship which included some more AIF reinforcements, so we're heading to the front. And they left Australia for London. And at that point, had they arrived, he would have been formally invested of the order and he would have taken, or would have been at least eligible to take his seat in the House of Lords in London. But he dies on the way there. Nonetheless, from the moment he's advised of his nomination, essentially, he styled himself as Lord Forrest. He, would sign off his name as Forrest from thereafter. So he essentially adopted that. And his wife remained Lady Forrest for the rest of her life.
Right.
So, he was a really interesting interesting and really sad sort of missed opportunity that he had in having received the honour but not yet having it conferred and that opportunity taken. Yeah.
What was his most important legacies, do you think?
There's some fairly traditional interpretations of that. There'd be people who'd argue that, while he was Premier in the 1890s, that was when this extraordinary expansion of the West Australian colony takes place as a result of the gold rushes.
Yes.
And this really matters because it totally transforms what's otherwise
all that
this
money. Yeah.
Absolutely. And even right up until then, that the colonial economy was impoverished and it was stagnant and it was difficult and so on. And in the space of 10 years, the population quadruples in the colony as a result of that resources boom. And so he presides over the first decade of self-government and over an economy that's really healthy. And he's quite pragmatic. He regards the goldfields as being probably of temporary nature. And instead he uses that opportunity to build the economic and the social stability of the colony more broadly. So that's probably, I think, one of the significant outcomes is, you know, the infrastructure that he establishes, the goldfields pipeline, the establishment of the Fremantle Harbour and the establishment of a really significant rail network and so on. But I think really his most significant legacy, I think, is probably bringing Western Australia into the Federation and then his impact on early federalism in those first few years of the Federation. I think that's, without him having taken that role, our country, our federal union might have looked quite different.
Sure. Deborah, terrific to talk. Thank you.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.